Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. I'm very pleased today to welcome Sam Funkhauser to the podcast. Sam is director of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics. He's been at the Institute since its inception a decade ago, where he initially joined as a principal research fellow. Sam also holds positions as deputy director of the Centre for Climate Change Economics and Policy and non-executive director at the CDC Group, the UK's development finance institution. Sam's research interests include the economics of adaptation to climate change, climate finance, and the functioning of carbon markets and climate change policy in the UK. Thank you very much, Sam, for taking the time to speak to me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So can you maybe tell me a little bit about your work today and really the work and focus of the Grantham Research Institute?
Well, yeah, the Grantham Research Institute is a research centre at the London School of Economics. We're about 40, 50 people, plus the same number again in visitors, PhD students, associates. So we're quite a sizable group being based at the LSE. We do what LSE is known for, that's economic and social science research. In our case, we apply those tools to climate change and the environment. We keep, perhaps unusually for a research center at the university, we keep a keen eye on the policy debate. So one thing we want to do is to engage with decision makers and help decision makers make better, more informed decisions. So that's very much our objective. We don't just do research for the ivory tower, as it were.
Absolutely. Now, when we talked about some of the questions we were going to cover on this, I at the outset was going to ask you a little bit about how bad things are. Now, I know that it's a criticism that's been made or a comment at least about some aspect of the environmental movement or people concerned about the environment is framing things in a negative way or you know, that people get worn out by hearing about the challenges and the difficulties that lie ahead. Now, you mentioned that you liked to talk about it in a different way, that you talked about the low carbon opportunities. Can you talk a little bit about that, why that's important to you, how you frame this whole topic?
Well, I think it's important to sort of understand what we're doing and the journey we're embarking on. It is true that we're gently running out of time if we want to meet the Paris objective of keeping global warming to well below 2 degrees centigrade. But it's also important to see that we're not just talking a story of limits and not being allowed to do things. We're also talking about the story of new opportunities. If you look at what's happening in the clean technology world, electric cars, solar panels, offshore wind. There's a huge amount of investment, excitement, growth, innovation going into those sectors. And we're starting to sort of be able to tell the story more credibly that the growth of this century, the growth of the 21st century is low carbon growth, and that we can actually do have prosperity and a cleaner environment at the same time. I think it's important to frame the debate in those terms. There are certain things we're no longer allowed to do or able to do, but it isn't a sort of a hair shirt story. It is very much a prosperity story.
Yes. Yeah. So how tangible are the low carbon opportunities, Sam?
It's they're growing. I mean, if you look at the clean tech sector, you know, there's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of money going in. The car industry is really putting a lot of money into batteries and electric cars. That's sort of a trend that I find hard to imagine how that would be stopped. We look at renewable energy, solar panels, how quickly they have come down in price. In the UK, we had an auction recently on offshore wind power, and the price was sort of well below anything that anybody had expected, including sort of experts who are in that sector, to the point where those technologies are now competitive with the sort of technologies that emit and the technologies that we're used to. So there's a huge amount of innovation going into those sectors. At the moment, it's mostly transport, I would say, surface transport and electricity generation. But we will have to go and look broader. We will look at innovation in aviation, for example. We need that. We need innovation in products and processes in industry, new materials. And that is happening. But at the moment, the forefront is electricity and cars, I would say.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I'm interested to talk to you today about an area. I know you've done a lot of research, the area of carbon taxes. And I just wondering whether you could maybe kind of summarize one or two of the most important arguments for a carbon tax.
Well, let me broaden that and give you first the most important arguments for putting a price on carbon. There's various ways in which a price can be put on carbon. A tax is obviously one of them. It's a very straightforward sort of administrative way of putting a price on carbon. But you can also have trading schemes. You can trade permits, emission reduction permits. So there are two ways in which you can price carbon. They're both sort of important, and we probably come back to that. What is the argument then for putting a price on carbon? Well, there's a philosophical argument, and then there's a practical argument. The philosophical argument is that we want to make the polluters pay, the people who cause the environmental harm, as it were, the emitters of fossil fuels should be asked to pay for the damages they cause. And that can be done through carbon pricing. That's sort of a well-established principle of environmental policies, polluters pay. In economic jargon, in environmental economics, and here's a nasty piece of jargon, we talk about an externality and the need to bring that externality into the market setup, to internalize it. An externality is something that causes a cost that is not reflected in the price of that activity. So if I buy a kilowatt hour of electricity that comes from a coal-fired power station, I pay for the coal, I pay for the workers, I pay for the transmission, but I do not pay for the environmental damage that this activity has caused. And we have to make markets function efficiently, we have to make sure that all products cover the full cost of their production. So that's the philosophy. In practical terms, I like carbon pricing because it works. There's a lot of empirical evidence that shows that people respond to price signals. If something becomes more expensive, they do less of it, or they find ways of making it cheaper to avoid, ways of avoiding the emissions. There's a lot of empirical evidence that that price signal actually has an impact on people's behavior. So for practical reasons alone, let alone the philosophy, I think it's a good idea to put the price on carbon.
And where are we now in the state of development, would you say, of carbon pricing? I know there's been carbon taxes, carbon emission schemes, some more successful than others. It seems quite a complex area.
Well, it is a complex area in the sense that there's different, you know, there are different ways in which you can put the price on carbon. You can either have taxation, or you can have a trading scheme. You can have a sort of a hybrid combination of the two. And there's sort of various technical ways in which you can set these things up. So it is complex because there's a lot of technicality in the design of those schemes. But there's an increasing number of emissions. It's about 15% of global emissions at the moment that are covered by a carbon price. So that is a, you know, that's a significant number. In my opinion, it should be all emissions, but that's a very good start. So carbon pricing is extending. It's extending not just in industrialized countries, but it's also increasing number of emerging markets that look at carbon pricing. China is probably the most prominent example. China has is home to one of the world's three biggest carbon markets. The other two are in California and in Europe. So China, as an emerging market, is very serious about putting a price on carbon. But a lot of other countries are as well. Let me single out one, Sweden, which has been pricing carbon through a tax since 1990. And Sweden is a prosperous country, so you can't say that it has been overly damaging to the Swedish economy.
Right. And what kind of prices are emerging, and what kind of price is required, would you say, to hit the targets for the Paris Agreement? That's a very big question. I'm sure there are many assumptions necessary to talk about that. But broadly speaking...
Well, the prices we observe at the moment you can summarize as being too low. The typical carbon prices in the schemes I mentioned in the European Union trading scheme in California, or some of the carbon taxes we observe, say, in British Columbia or in the UK, they're sort of in single-digit euros or pounds per ton of carbon, which does provide a certain signal, and it does change behavior, and we can empirically show that. But if you ask what is the carbon price that we need to meet the Paris commitment, you're sort of more talking of something that is in the 40 to 80 euros per ton in 2020, and then rising to something like 50 to 100 euros per ton by 2030. Those are not my numbers, incidentally. Those are numbers that come from a panel of very eminent economists that have produced a report earlier this year on carbon pricing. It was the report was led by Nick Stern and Joe Stiglitz, so two very prominent economists who have looked at that very carefully.
So how are we going to get there, Sam?
Well, that's the interesting question, and it's a question of political economy as much as it's a question of economics. The political economy of putting a price on carbon is complicated, because surprisingly complicated, I should say, because if you want to simplify it, people don't like taxes. People are suspicious about taxes, and putting a price on carbon ultimately does resemble a tax in one way or another, even if it's a trading scheme. And that, I say, surprising, because I started off saying that we're talking here about an environmental correction. We're talking about making the polluters pay. And you could think that consumers would like the ideas of making polluters pay, but they're too suspicious of governments. They think that it isn't actually about making the polluter pay, it's about making themselves pay, it's about the government raising revenue. So you have to design your carbon taxes quite carefully to account for those suspicions that your electorate will have about those schemes. A lot of that is very careful communication as to why you're doing it, how you're doing it, who is paying how much, how the revenues are being recycled. And if you do that, you have a much higher chance of getting those schemes through Parliament.
Yes. Now, one thing that many commentators talk about is the regressive nature, potentially, of carbon taxes. Presumably, it's a technical question. What do we know about dealing with that?
Well, the regressive nature of a tax is absolutely true. That means that poor people, as a share of their income, pay a higher share of the tax than rich people do. That's sort of empirically well proven to be the case, although it tends to be softened if you look beyond just energy consumption and so also look at the energy that's embedded in all the other things that we consume. So the energy that went into making your iPhone or something like that. And if you do that, carbon pricing becomes slightly less regressive, because rich people consume things that are more energy and carbon intensive to make. Nevertheless, it is an issue, and it's something that one has to look at. Again, there are measures in which you can soften the regressiveness of a carbon tax. You can have targeted compensation. In the UK, for example, there's things like winter fuel allowance that make sure that people have enough income to keep warm in winter. The other thing that one can do, which is very important, is energy efficiency measures targeted at low-income households. Because ultimately what matters isn't the price of electricity or the price of energy, it's the size of the energy bill. And the energy bill consists of the price per kilowatt hour times the number of kilowatt hours you consume. And if you can bring down the number of kilowatt hours you consume through energy efficiency, through loft insulation, solid wall insulation, more efficient boilers, and so on, then the energy bill, the thing that really matters, goes up by a lot less, because consumption goes down, price may go up, but the bill stays constant. That's what we've observed in the UK, actually, where bills have roughly remained constant despite sort of an increasing number of green taxes that we have put on those bills.
Right. And do you expect that to hold when you talk about figures which are multiples? You're talking about $50, $60, $70.
There's a lot more energy efficiency to be had. We are not very good at energy efficiency, so there's a lot of energy efficiency potential that we haven't realized. But obviously, it is finite. At some point, we sort of reached physical limits, as it were, of energy efficiency, and bills may well go up. And that's when issues of targeted compensation, income support, perhaps even sort of structural ways like block tariffs, where the first set of kilowatt hours that you consume are cheaper than the sort of the final luxury sets of kilowatt hours. So you can find ways through the structure or through direct compensation, which you can keep bills down.
Yes, I guess a lot depends on the political will. Now, you mentioned the EU, you mentioned China, you mentioned California. Would you say that the pace of marketization, I suppose, or carbon pricing is increasing? And how much is it?
I mean, the pace is certainly increasing in terms of the number of jurisdictions that are considering it, that are looking at it. There's a clear interest in looking at these things. Ironically, some of those jurisdictions, including in the US, are looking at it also with an eye of the government revenue that can be raised, which obviously, going back to where we started, the cynicism of the electorate who do see these things as a revenue raising device sort of gets fulfilled to some extent in that. But you know, in the US, there's sort of pushes towards a carbon tax, including from industry. Industry looks at this from the point of view of saying climate change policy is a fact. We will have it. We do need to solve the problem. And so we are more interested in rational policies than in efficient policies. And from that point of view, we prefer a carbon tax over some of the other regulations that we might have.
Yes, yes. And we talk about a market. How is the price in the market determined? Presumably, the government has a big role to play here.
Well, we're now talking about an emissions trading scheme as opposed to a carbon tax. In a carbon tax, the government just sets the tax rate.
Yes.
In an emissions trading scheme, the setup is that a certain number of permits, sort of allowances to emit a ton of CO2 over a year, are being issued. And if you, as a company, as an emitter, emit a certain amount of carbon, and you have to buy the equivalent amount of permits and submit those permits to your regulators. The government comes in because the government or its sort of dedicated regulatory entity issues those permits. The permits can either be given away for free, which often happens as a way of inducing industry to participate, or they can be auctioned, and in which case the government organizes those auction schemes.
Yes. Now, can you talk about, you've got that you mentioned there's the emissions trading, and you've got the tax, and there's a range of different approaches in different markets and so forth. Is that okay? Is there, you know, that there'll be a patchwork of different kinds of systems, and will is there an expectation that prices should what's the word?
Converge.
Yes. Yes.
I'm very relaxed about the fact that different jurisdictions have different sort of pricing schemes. The fact that British Columbia has a carbon tax, and you know, a couple of hundred miles south in California, they have an emissions trading scheme. That doesn't matter very much. What matters more is the relative prices that are being raised across those jurisdictions, because that, in a sense, creates a level or unlevel playing fields. If one tax rate is high and the other is low, obviously it moves emissions to the low taxation scheme, and in the long run, that is probably undesirable. So there will have to be an element of convergence in tax rates, or to reformulate that, tax rates have to reflect what countries' common but differentiated responsibilities are under the Paris Agreement. Common but differentiated responsibilities is a key word in the international negotiations, which reflects that not every country is in the same economic situation, and not every country has contributed the same amount to the problem. So you can have different carbon pricing levels to reflect those differences. But in an ideal world, you would have a uniform carbon price across firms and fuels, because that allows the market to figure out where emissions are cut most cheaply.
Yes. Any signs that that's happening?
Not very many, to be honest. There's what current carbon pricing schemes have in common is that they have a very low carbon price, so they're uniform
Yes,
in
yes.
jointly being wrong. But there isn't sort of a sign of convergence. What might lead to convergence is a growing interest amongst various jurisdictions to link up their trading schemes. We've, for example, seen some Canadian provinces linking up with the Californian trading scheme. And when you link up in that way, obviously you unify your carbon prices. You will have one carbon price across the two linked up jurisdictions. Jurisdictions don't link up because they like the unified carbon price. They link up because they see the efficiency gains of linking up. There's a lot of economic gains to be had on both sides, actually, by linking up your trading schemes.
Right. Now, can you talk a little bit about the use of shadow pricing in corporates, and just where do corporates fit in with respect to carbon pricing?
Corporates are very important, because a lot of what needs to be done ultimately has to be affected by firms, by the private sector. So it's not just governments and households. Firms are very, very important. To some extent, firms are being exposed to a carbon price through regulatory means. So if you're an emitter in Europe, you're exposed to the EU emissions trading scheme, so you get a carbon price through your friendly EU regulator. But a lot of firms have sort of imposed their own internal carbon pricing scheme, basically because they sort of want to understand what their carbon footprint is, but also to understand what their carbon risks are. If they invest in certain high carbon assets, they don't factor in the carbon price in their decision making, they run the risk that they create a stranded asset that further down the line, the regulatory agency or governments that are keen on meeting their Paris commitments will stop them from using those assets in the intended way. So using a shadow price for carbon within firms is one way of dealing, managing, understanding those carbon risks.
Yes, and as I understand it, some of the shadow prices are significantly higher than the kind of prices that we're seeing emerging in these other markets.
That's correct. Going back to the recommendations of the commission by Nick Stern and Joseph Stiglitz, the sort of 40 to 80 euros per ton of CO2 by 2020, those are probably roughly the sort of carbon prices that one observes in industry. And the reason why they probably have a higher carbon price is that they don't sort of grapple with the political economy of convincing voters to accept those levels of carbon prices as politicians do. If you're the CEO of a company, you can rationally sort of say what is the likely carbon regulation that an agreement like the Paris Agreement entails, and then use that carbon price as the most accurate reflection of what those regulatory implications might be.
Yes. So, how should we view the recent calls by major corporates, including ExxonMobil, BP, for a carbon tax in the United States?
Well, there's the cynical view and the less cynical view on that. The cynical view would go slightly as follows. There's a recognition that carbon taxes are very difficult to incorporate politically, much more difficult than trading schemes because of the word tax that appears in the title. And therefore, if you want to block the momentum towards carbon pricing, if you advocate the carbon tax, you sort of make sure you slow the thing down and make it as complicated as possible. So that view is certainly out there. There's a less cynical view, which I hope will be true, and it was certainly true in Europe, was certainly true in the UK, where industry recognized that climate change was a serious problem, a problem that had to be solved, a problem that would entail regulation and government intervention. And industry then said, if I have to be regulated on my carbon emissions, I'd like to be regulated in a rational, efficient, forward-looking way. And the most rational, efficient, and forward-looking way for industry is having a carbon tax or an emissions trading scheme. So that's what industry then advocated.
Yes, I suppose at the same time you could say, well, it's all in the detail. A carbon tax is fine, but if it's, comes to a price of $10 or something like that, that's fine. But if you're actually talking about maybe $80 to $100, maybe people wouldn't be so open to it
I mean,
in
that's
that sense.
absolutely true. It isn't just the absolute price level, which obviously is one issue of debate, but also the level of exemptions that you put into your taxation scheme. I mentioned Sweden earlier as a country that has a very high carbon tax level and has had for 20 plus years. But there are also significant exemptions in the Swedish carbon tax plan. So it isn't just the sort of the headline number of the tax rate, it is also the loopholes that you put into your schemes.
Yes. Now, you mentioned the word tax, which is obviously problematic for some, notwithstanding the economic arguments. What about the emission schemes, and what would you say are the lessons there? The various trading schemes, some have been more successful than others, and is this the way forward?
It is only a way forward. I've always been fascinated by emissions trading scheme as a sort of a ingenious way of achieving an environmental objective. And there are environmental markets that existed before there was carbon trading. They're in the US markets on sulfur and NOx that have been very effective in solving those particular environmental problems. The lessons we learned from the carbon markets, and again the big ones where one can learn lessons from, is the EU emissions trading scheme, the Californian trading scheme, and now emerging a set of Chinese pilots, but there's trading schemes elsewhere as well. A couple of things that we learn from that is A, the prices do tend to come in low, and that's a combination of regulators not understanding what the sort of the emissions profile and the emission reduction costs are amongst the firms they're regulating. So there's an element of asymmetric information there. So too many permits get issued just because the regulator doesn't know the true situation. prices are also low because there isn't a sort of a complete trust that the system would be there for the long term, and the supply of permits would be tightened, so the prices would go up. There's sort of an element of short-termism in those markets. So most regulated firms respond by doing short-term operational adjustments. They have a harder time doing the long-term investment decisions that we will need. So carbon markets are better at the short-term guidance than the long-term guidance. I think that's sort of important as we go along. But we also, you know, there's empirical evidence that emissions do come down. The systems work. Emissions stay within the cap, so the environmental objective is being met. There's also evidence that trading or emissions pricing leads to innovation, so to long-term efficiency gains. And there's this little evidence at the moment for the schemes we have that it has been overly detrimental to the regulated firms in terms of their productivity.
Right, right. Now, I guess you've got the potential, you've got the developed countries and the global south, the emerging markets. I'm just wondering, are there some questions there in terms of how they're looking at carbon taxes and carbon markets?
Well, there's sort of the broader question in developing countries as to what their role should be in the global fight against climate change. As you, those who remember back to the sort of the 20, 30 year history of negotiations under the Kyoto Protocol, the 1997 sort of precursor to Paris, if you will, there was a clear distinction between industrialized countries who had to reduce their emissions and developing countries who didn't. That divide is now under Paris a lot softer, and it's recognized that all countries have to make a contribution. By implication, all countries will look at the right policy instruments to make that contribution, and carbon pricing is an effective way of doing that in countries that have a high emissions base, countries like China, for example, where carbon pricing is looked at.
Can you say in some sense that some countries will lose out from carbon pricing relatively? And is there an argument to be made for how to deal with something like that?
I don't think so. I mean, every sort of deep structural change like the one we're going through, where we decarbonize the world economy, every such structural change creates winners and losers. And obviously there will be losers. There will be in particular sectors. And they will be spread across countries, but there will also be winners, and those winners are also spread across countries. And a lot of emerging markets realize that. You look at countries like China, South Korea, I think Rwanda is another example. They don't have climate change laws. The title of their laws to deal with climate change are called green growth laws. They see climate change as environmental policy, but they also see it as industrial policy. Korea is probably the best example. Their green growth law is very explicitly aimed at making Korea the global leader in the low carbon economy. Korea wants its firms to have a comparative advantage in that economy that is coming, that is low carbon and climate resilient.
That's very interesting. And talk about relative about sectors and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about carbon leakage, explain what it is, the impact on competitiveness, and how to deal with that?
Yeah, there's sort of two twin terms here that people use. One is carbon leakage and the other is competitiveness. What we are talking about here is the impact of a unilateral carbon price or unilateral carbon policy. If I'm the only country that puts a price on carbon, then there's a possibility that my industry, say my steel industry or my cement industry or my pulp and paper industry, will migrate abroad to jurisdictions that do not face those regulatory burdens. And then competitiveness reflects the loss of jobs and revenue that goes with that migration, and leakage reflects the relocation of emissions that goes with that move. Now, empirically, we've had carbon regulation, particularly in Europe, for 10, 12 years, so we can empirically see where the leakage has happened. And the empirical evidence suggests that there hasn't been much of it. That doesn't mean there wouldn't be leakage and competitiveness effects if we had higher carbon prices, we had the sort of carbon prices that we actually do need. That is quite possible. But there's one counter argument to that, which is that other countries are increasingly also putting carbon prices on their industries. And it's the relative carbon price that matters, the carbon price in my jurisdiction versus the jurisdiction industry might migrate to. And to the extent that countries are implementing their Paris agreements through carbon pricing, as for example China is doing, that sort of unilateral distortion is starting to fall away.
Right. And to the extent that countries are doing this individually, as you say, as part of the Paris Agreement and so forth, where does the question of governance or international agreements or mechanisms to bring together different schemes and things like that?
Well, there's obviously we have the Paris Agreement, and the Paris Agreement is about a sort of a globally agreed level of ambition and as an element of consensus as to which country contributes how much to that global consensus. So politically, through Paris, we develop a sense as to who should and who can do how much to the problem.
I'm talking more about the carbon prices or the carbon markets themselves.
So that there's then the question as to whether you want the individual carbon markets to be linked up, and whether there's merit in a global carbon market. So I do not think we're anywhere near of having a global carbon price or a sort of a globally regulated carbon market. I'm not even sure that would be the most sort of desirable thing to have. It's much more likely to see a system emerging where individual countries have their regional carbon trading schemes, as Europe has, as California has, and those jurisdictions then start talking to each other and start looking at the merits of linking up. And we have done some work on what we call carbon dating, as in which carbon market do you want to ask for a date and sort of, you know, link up with. And there's two things are quite clear. The first is that it's beneficial to link up carbon markets. So individual jurisdictions will want to do that because it helps them meet their environmental targets at lower costs. The second thing that is also clear is that your choice of partner matters. In particular, you want to link up with a partner that is relatively big. So you have a big pool of emission reductions opportunities that you associate yourself with. And you want a partner that is not economically correlated with you, so that when my economy is booming and my emissions prices are high, my partner economy is flatlining and has not so high emissions permit prices, so that we can trade some of the overheating away. And then the other way around, if I'm flatlining, my partner is booming and is taking up some of my slack permits. So there is a sort of a science as to whom you want to sort of cooperate with. But cooperation is clearly a good thing.
Yes. And does the scale, the size of the market, because financial markets tend to like scale, and what role do financial investors have to play?
The size of the market absolutely matters, because you want liquidity in a system. You want the ability to trade your permits very freely, very easily. You want to know that there's somebody who's going to sell you one if you need one and is gonna buy yours if you want to get rid of them. So liquidity matters, and that has to do with the size of the market. Size of the market also plays a role because increases the pool of opportunities to find emission reductions. The bigger the market, you know, the more factories, the more emission reduction opportunities you're able to unearth. So that clearly matters. The role of investors. Clearly, the emission reductions that have to happen, they will have to be financed. So we need a financial system that is comfortable financing offshore wind farms or electric car plants and low carbon opportunities like that. And we need a financial sector who understands and trusts the carbon pricing schemes they operate in, because those carbon pricing schemes set the regulatory context within which they invest.
Yes, yes. Now, you mentioned about 15% of global emissions are covered by carbon prices, and we're talking about quite low figures at the moment. Can you see a path forward to an effective price on carbon emissions, and what kind of time frame would you think this needs to be?
I wouldn't speculate on the time frame, but it's a quite clear direction of travel, and the direction of travel is that more and more jurisdictions look at carbon pricing as an option. And even those jurisdictions that already have pricing schemes may look at expanding them, bringing new sector into it, or finding parallel schemes to deal with the sectors that are not currently covered in the EU. For example, the emissions trading scheme covers about 40 or so percent of emissions now, and that leaves close to 60% of emissions that are not covered. And it might be that the EU will want a carbon tax for those 60% of emissions, so broadening the scope. Countries like the US that we talked about might probably at the state level at this point in time look at taxation schemes. So I see the number of 15% of emissions covered going up. And as it goes up, there's sort of probably an element of momentum. We know from the empirical literature that there is such a thing as policy diffusion, that regulators learn from each other and sort of copy each other almost. We did some studies on climate change legislation. We have a database of 1,400 pieces of climate change legislation, and we looked at what are the determining factors of passing a climate law, and one of them is the number of laws that your trade partners and your neighbors and your
yes.
cultural sort of
yes.
countries with whom you have a cultural affinity, if they have more carbon laws, you're more likely to have one.
Right. You mentioned there are different pricing approaches. You know, there's the tax or emissions trading. What broadly are the differences between these from a policy perspective?
Well, there's differences in the way they sort of work economically, and there's differences in the political economy, in the way you set them up and pass them. In terms of the economics, to simplify matters, if you set an emissions trading scheme, you have certainty about your environmental outcome. You know exactly how many permits you issue, so that's clear. But you're uncertain about the economic burden that you create, because the price level is unclear, will be determined by the market, and the price level will fluctuate. So if you have a trading scheme, you have certainty about emissions, uncertainty about the price. If you have a tax scheme, it's exactly the other way around. You know what the tax level is because that's what you set. You have certainty about the price, but you're unclear how many emission reductions you will get for that tax, right? So you have uncertainty about the environmental outcome. Now, what should you choose? Certainty over the tax rate or certainly over the outcome? There's a lot of sophisticated literature that tries to explain that. Ultimately, for me, it's more important that you set the right price, whether you do it through tax or permits is secondary. And setting the right price is then the political economy difference between taxation and trading. And it tends to be the case that trading systems are easier to set up politically, because the word tax doesn't appear. in the title, and also you're creating an asset. Emission permits are an asset; they're worth something, and you can use those assets to create coalitions of firms and people who are interested in the trading scheme. So that's why a lot of schemes start off by giving permits away for free. You give the asset away for free; that gives you buy-in. So in terms of political economy, a trading scheme is probably easier than a taxation scheme. But again, the main criteria for me is whatever works politically in your jurisdiction, that is what you should do.
Right. Now, what about the obstacles? Politics, important, you mentioned the word tax, it's got tax in it. Are there any other significant obstacles to carbon pricing?
Well, the obstacles have to do with vested interests. So there's obviously there's a set of high carbon industries that will be the main losers from that scheme. Will have to pay the highest tax bill, and so there's an element of resistance from them, which one can overcome again through compensation schemes, allocation of permits, and so on. When it comes to taxation, there is sort of voters and consumers do not like taxation. They're very suspicious as to whether it will do what it's intended to do, reduce emissions, to what extent it's just a way of raising revenue, to what extent it is unfair on low-income households. All those things are concerns to voters when they see carbon taxation schemes. You can overcome them by being very careful in the way you communicate what your tax will do. If you're very careful, upfront, and transparent as to what the tax rate is, who pays how much of the revenue gets recycled, and in what way, and what the environmental benefits are that you achieve, then people sort of come around and start accepting carbon taxes.
Great. And what are the lessons? You mentioned the Swedish scheme a few times. Are there a few lessons that we can draw from their experience and the success they've had?
The Swedish scheme is one of the schemes I would look at. The other one I would look at is British Columbia, which have a very successful in Canada, British Columbia and Canada, which has a very successful and innovative carbon tax. Again, the lessons there are mostly on communications and to transparency in which the schemes are set up and explain, and then a very careful policy on how tax revenues are being recycled so that people understand what happens with the money and derive comfort that it isn't just a revenue raising scheme, that it is actually an environmental scheme.
Right. Are you optimistic then, Sam?
I'm optimistic about the sort of the direction of travel on the political will. I think we will see more carbon policies and better carbon policies enacted. I'm very optimistic about technological progress in areas like energy, transport, and so on. So there's that momentum that leads us to low carbon prosperity and low carbon growth is very much there. The question, will we do it quick enough to meet the well below 2 degrees Paris target? Well, we're slightly running out of time there. It's still doable, very much doable, but we might need a little bit of help from the climate system. What I mean by that is that we have to hope that the climate system is slightly less sensitive to carbon emissions than some of the estimates we have.
Yes, yes. And what's next for the Grantham Research Institute, Sam?
Oh, what's next for us, inward looking, we will be 10 years old next year. In terms of what we want to do, we want to continue to engage with the policy community on climate change. There are two processes that we are particularly interested in. One is the implementation of the Paris Agreement. How can we meaningfully increase ambition? What are the government's governance requirements one needs for that? So we want to be engaged with that. We also want to be engaged in the UK debate, which is a fascinating debate. The UK is one of the leaders on climate change and climate change policy, but we are entering a new phase with tighter carbon targets, but obviously we're also entering a new phase with Brexit. So we want to engage with the UK, but also with the wider community on climate policy.
Well, I wish you the very best of success with that, Simon. Thank you so much for taking the time to explain the intricacies of the carbon pricing and carbon markets. It's a great interview, and I thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.